ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When you want to be stopped in your tracks.
I'm running to shoot it. It's 50-50. You can catch his gun or he shoot you.
When you want to know the truth.
She was brainwashing her from the start.
We're here to investigate.
Something's gone wrong. Big time.
Search Background Briefing Podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, we've got a special episode of ABC Business Daily for you today. There's so much heated political debate at the moment about Australia's immigration program. And last week I found an email in my inbox which dealt with the economic outcomes for Australia's skilled migration program and some really interesting insights into how migrants do depending on which visa they get to come over to Australia. So if you'll bear with us, this is a special episode and a slightly different format than you used to, but I think you'll really enjoy the chat. So welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Dr. Peter Varela, Research Fellow at the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at the Australian National University.
Peter, thank you so much for joining me on the pod. Give me an idea of what sparked this particular piece of research. What questions were you trying to answer through it?
Okay, so migration policy has always been a really, really important policy, both for economic reasons, for sort of broader nation building reasons, and for just sort of general welfare of Australians and migrants. It's always been a really important policy. My interest in this sort of sparks from the availability of data. As of about 10 years ago, there was sort of access to sort of large data sets that allowed us to track the outcomes of migrants, allowed us to see where they work, how much they earn, the occupations that they're working in, which has sort of opened up a big field of research, but also sort of big opportunities for thinking through how the migration program works that wasn't quite as easily available before that data was here.
I'm going to start with one of the issues that I thought was most interesting to me because it seemed to fly in the face of kind of accepted kind of orthodoxy, which is there doesn't seem to be a strong link between migrants studying at Australian universities and how well they do in the labour market. It doesn't seem to indicate that they're actually going to earn more money when they work within Australia if they came here to study first. Can you talk us through that?
No, exactly. This is one of the big outcomes of our research, that if you look at people who've studied in Australia as an international student, track them through when they get a permanent skilled visa and sort of look at the likelihood that they sort of utilize those Australian qualifications in the labour market, the likelihood that they work in the jobs that they nominate through the visa process, they sort of have almost surprisingly bad outcomes compared to people coming through other pathways. And I say surprisingly, because if you'd asked me this question kind of 20 years ago, how do you get really good labour market outcomes for migrants, I would have said, get them to study at Australian universities, get them sort of qualified with, I mean, Australia has fantastic universities, get them to study at the Australian sort of level, have them sort of integrate into the culture and the language through that process, and it'll all work well. But when you actually look at what's happened, that is not the case. And that's sort of, again, cutting edge research. This is where we are at the moment. But yeah, that's an important thing that we're trying to get into the policy discussion at the moment.
It does seem to fly in the face of what I think most people would have expected. And I think one of the strong arguments from the higher education industry, right? They keep talking about it's our third biggest export earner with a huge amount of money is being ploughed into Australian universities by foreign students studying there. And your research looks at just that pathway from coming over on a student visa and then getting a different type of visa to work within Australia. And yet it appears that those people who've come through Australian universities aren't doing as well in the workforce as, say, bringing someone over on a skilled visa to start off with if they've studied overseas. So how can we understand this? Because, as you say, you would think if you've come here, you've studied in an Australian university, we have good universities, world-class universities, they've spent time within the Australian environment, They've learned some of those cultural norms, etc. Why are they doing worse?
So you do have to be sort of careful not to try to have a single answer to that. But the single answer I'm going to try to give, use the word pathways, the pathways that people follow from Australian education to a permanent visa. There isn't a clear pathway for this cohort. There are lots of different things that people do. There are graduate visas. There are the possibility to go from a graduate visa to a temporary employer-sponsored visa. There are state and territory-nominated visas. There are various different things. But essentially, that pathway is not working particularly well. And the way that I would characterize that, we are encouraging people to do things for points. We're encouraging people to study in regional areas, to do language tests, to do the sort of professional year programs that are available in some occupations, rather than sort of giving the advice that you would give to a non-migrant graduate, which is go and get a grad job, do your best to get into the labor market. And so that's sort of the headline advice. Can we find a way to get a cleaner pathway for these cohorts into the Australian labour market?
So let's talk through that. The points system when it comes to getting a working visa in Australia. You talk about you get extra points for going to a regional area by doing English tests. How problematic is that system? And the design of the point system was supposed to kind of have a system in place that helped us get the migrants that were most likely to do well, right? Why is it failing?
Okay, so I should start with the sort of acknowledgement that there is an item in the budget that says that there is going to be an optimization of the points test. So this is something that is there. There's very little additional information on this at the moment. It's something that we expect more information over the coming months. But there is sort of policy moving in this space. In terms of that points test, there are a couple of different ways that you can think about what's going wrong and how to improve it. The first is that over the last sort of 20, 30 years, we have added things to the points test. So we've added a range of these items, things like studying regional areas, things like professional years. And as a result, we kind of have various things in the points test at the moment that aren't particularly predictive of migrant outcomes. Some of them are indeed negatively correlated with migrant outcomes. And so there's sort of a low-hanging fruit option here, which is just to kind of clean out the points test, get rid of the categories that have been added over time that aren't doing a lot to improve that process. But I'm also sort of kind of optimistic that we might do a little bit better.
There's obviously been a debate as well about whether or not part of what universities have been selling is not just about education, but it's a pathway to visas. Did your research go into that? And do you have a firm view on whether or not that is the case? And is that a good or a bad thing?
There is no way to kind of measure that. So I'm an empirical researcher. My job is to go into the visa system and see what's happening. And the question you've just asked of how many people go through the student pathway as a sort of a ticket to residency is very difficult to kind of directly measure. I will start from the kind of the important statement that international education is a fantastic thing to be able to sell. It is an export market that every country would love to have. It is sort of a thing that has wonderful productivity tax spillovers within Australia. It also has sort of really important international relations benefits. So if you talk to DFAT, they will sort of see international education as a really important mechanism.
It's kind of soft power.
Soft power, exactly. And so the international education, it is a sort of very valuable on a lot of important dimensions. So when we talk about how we want to think about this pathway, we do have to be very careful not to sort of get too down on this exercise. We still have a fantastic education system. Now, in terms of how closely you want to tie education to that permanent migration pathway, this is kind of an ongoing debate, and it's a pendulum that kind of swings back and forth for different countries. If you go back, there was the Knight Review in Australia, and there was a concern at that time that we maybe want to tie these, make it a clearer pathway for migrants. And so some of the reforms at that point, the graduate visa reforms, the adding of studying in Australia to the points test, were designed to sort of encourage that pathway. And the way I sort of see it is a bit of a pendulum back at this point to kind of separate out education in Australia, that international study, with the pathway a little bit. And so I think people would be sort of relatively on board with that pendulum swinging back. It's just a question of how far is where the disagreement goes.
Okay, so you did look at potential, or you've been thinking about potential solutions to this problem. If it is the case that students studying in Australia aren't doing as well as people studying overseas, and you're trying to kind of unpick that relationship, I guess, regarding migration and the higher education system, what would you do to change the way that working visas are allocated in order to ensure that you're getting the right migrants when you're looking at kind of economic prosperity?
So selective migration program, skills migration program are essentially about getting people into jobs in the Australian labour market and trying to get them in pretty quickly into those jobs. If you miss several years, it's going to be harder to kind of catch up. That's kind of your goal. The way that I approach this, we have two broad sort of styles of visas. We have ones that are independent. Our points-tested visas are known as independent visas. And we have our employer-sponsored visas, where in order to get a visa, you have to have an employer that's willing to sort of vouch for you on that visa. At a high level, you can make the statement that points-tested visas do well in some sections of the labour market, and they don't do particularly well in other sections of the labour market. So they do well in health. Doctors, nurses, allied health all seem to do quite well with the points-tested program. Now, there's a lot of other occupations as well, but health is kind of a nice one to visualise.
And this is that people who have these qualifications, if they're qualified as a doctor, they're qualified as a nurse, they are going to find it quite easy to find a job in that industry where there is a lot of occupations. And one of the ones that was striking to me was engineers and accountants. There's actually a very low percentage, is that right, of people who have this qualification who actually then work in those occupations.
Exactly. And just to clarify for listeners, what we're actually doing, we're asking what people nominate on their visas. So you have to nominate an occupation to get a visa. And then we're looking later in the tax data, sort of 5-10 years later, what proportion are working as engineers, what proportion are working as accountants. And you're right, those sort of broadly white-collar professional jobs do better through the employer-sponsored pathway than the independent pathway.
You're talking about people who've come over here, where businesses wanted to hire somebody from overseas. They've got the skill set that they need. That has a very high rate of obviously them working in that job versus other types of visas.
Yeah, exactly. There are some occupations that employer-sponsored sort of linkage, that sort of essentially the business, the company sort of looks at you and says, that's the special skill set that we want. You want to use that in some parts of the labor market, and in other parts of the labor market, knowing that you have a degree, knowing that you have a qualification in the occupation works just as well. So I think it's really just about tailoring the different types of visas to different parts of the labor market. And again, this is something that with this data, with this sort of ability to measure these outcomes, we can kind of make these statements now in a way that it was much, much harder to do 10 years ago.
There's a debate currently about, for example, construction workers, that we need to have a higher percentage of our migrant program bringing over construction workers. But you make the point that migrants granted visas for low-income occupations are much less likely to work in those occupations after migration. And so you do need to be careful about trying to address short-term labour challenges through a point system, and instead it's better to be looking at wage rises, et cetera. Is that right?
Exactly. So there's a sort of standard line that we use that if your occupation can't retain non-migrant workers, if the wages and conditions aren't sufficiently attractive to retain non-migrant workers, it's probably also not going to be able to retain migrant workers. And we sort of see empirically that low paid occupations have much lower long-term retention rates than higher paid occupations. Now, I will have to sort of jump in there and say, construction is typically not a low-paid occupation in the frameworks that we are using. So cooks and hairdressers are the sort of two occupations that we usually think of as historically having quite poor outcomes. These are pooled across all of the years in the migration program. We've had lots of cooks and hairdressers, and not particularly a lot of them continue to work in those occupations. The construction stuff is really hard because within construction, you have licensed trades and you have unlicensed trades, and each of those sort of occupations has a different framework for determining who can work on a particular site. Some of these are national level, but a lot of them are state level. And so essentially you need to think through very carefully which type of visa is going to make sense for these occupations. Be careful using visas to solve labor market shortage in low paid occupations. But I think construction has a whole world of challenges that are special to that sector.
Are you optimistic that there can be changes made relatively easily to get more from the system?
Oh, absolutely. This points test reform is not a surprise. It was sort of suggested in the 2023 review by Martin Parkinson. There were discussion papers in 2024 that were released by Home Affairs. There has been lots of discussions, and to be honest, there's lots of different things that you can do that are all sort of pushing in the right direction. I think it's just a question of how grand those reforms are going to be, whether they're the kind of narrow cleanup of the points test or whether they're the sort of more sort of ambitious, how do we use points test reform to help the student pathway sort of start to make sense.
The first option is this reform of the points test, but there is a second option that you looked into.
One of the things that we sort of did in our work was make the case, and I think we made the case fairly strongly, that the points test is trying to use one instrument to apply to two different groups. There is a group of migrants going through the points tested system that are not working in the Australian labour market. They might be offshore, or they might be recent Australian graduates who've just graduated from an Australian university. And then there are people who are working in the Australian labour market. And the case that we were making is that you actually want to think about these two groups very differently, that the information that you require to sort of predict long-term outcomes of someone who is currently already working in Australia is a very different information set. Now, our solution that we put forward in the paper was essentially just to use age and income of people working in the Australian labour market. It's a very clean economist's answer to that solution, but the deeper insight that you should think differently about people already here working and those that aren't, I think is the key. And there's lots of different ways that you can approach that question. And again, most of them would be improvements to the current system. So lots of different ways to improve the system.
So Peter, I guess taking a step back, why do we care about the economic impact of the skilled migration program?
Yeah, so we run a selective migration program. We like it when migrants come to Australia, earn money, and work in high paid jobs. This is good for migrants. Migrants are obviously happier if they earn money, but it's also sort of good for the broader economy. It sort of shows up in headline productivity if migrants are working in high paid jobs. And it also, if you take that sort of treasury line, it's good for taxes. Migrants that earn a lot of money pay more in taxes and receive less in government transfer payments. And that sort of saves us having some fairly hard trade-off discussions about tax policy. If we get the migration program working well, we don't have to raise as much in tax, or we can sort of give out more in government spending programs.
I'm going to ask you about some breaking news, and I know we aren't, you haven't had time to be fully up against across the detail, but you also appeared, is that right, at the Senate inquiry on Monday regarding the government's changes to the CGT tax discount.
Yep, that's correct.
The government has announced some pretty major changes. This seems to be in response to some of the backlash we have seen. So Treasurer Jim Chalmers says that they will lift the threshold for small businesses to access the 50% CGT discount up to $10 million, the revenue from the small business, I should say. which they say will now mean that 98% of all active businesses will be eligible for the concessions. There have also been some changes to the testamentary trusts, and they are still doing consultation both on them and on startups. Now, there are lots of details to this, but effectively the government is carving out pieces. There did seem to be a bit of an argument in part between economists. Many economists wanted to leave the system as is. They didn't want to see more carve-outs. They'd rather kind of pure system, whereas a lot of business groups were saying that this could be very problematic for startups in particular, but businesses more broadly. I mean, how do you sit, knowing the little detail that you've been able to get across? Are these changes necessary, or is this more of a political solution than an economic one?
As you mentioned, I now know as much about this policy as you have just informed me of over this. This has happened very, very recently. And the extension of the existing small business rules to a higher threshold, I would have to go and think very carefully about how important this was, just in practical terms.
But like this kind of question, isn't it, that it's about whether or not you think small business is special and should be treated differently to large enterprises?
No, exactly. And there is the case that that I made on Monday, very similar to the case that E61 made in the same session, was that we already have some concessions in the tax system for small business. Now, different people sort of get excited about small business. There's sort of questions about productivity that comes out of small business. There's questions about competition that comes out of small business. The tax economist also says you also have to worry about compliance, that if you give a tax concession to a particular group, you all of a sudden have to worry that that people will do things in order to get those sort of tax concessions.
As in, there might be there might be changes to company structure in order to be classified as a small business as opposed to a not small business.
No, exactly. Businesses do have discretion about how they set themselves up, and there will be sort of every time you change these business tax rules, there's sort of a discussion about how businesses will react. Now, the other really important insight here is to kind of split out the founders versus the return to sort of capital investment in these small firms. So founders, the people who are working, putting their labor into these firms, are taxed sort of at a significantly lower rate than the alternative, which is sort of labor income tax rates. So we're not really concerned at all about this group, whereas there is sort of a range of hurdle rates that if you increase the capital tax rates, you will make some investment less viable. As I said, we're already kind of subsidized against a benchmark, so adding some subsidy sort of takes us further in that direction. But again, it all kind of depends on whether you think small business is special and worthy of that tax advantage.
So the government has tried to come up with a forecast of how much this will cost. So the original changes announced in the budget, those changes to negative gearing, the capital gains tax discount, and taxation arrangements around trusts were supposed to make the budget $8.1 billion over the forward estimates to raise that amount of extra tax. They say these changes to the concessions will mean they're foregoing $475 million. Anyway, fascinating debate, one that you were part of. Let's see how this plays out in the coming weeks. That is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. Tomorrow, be sure to catch That's Business with Alan Kohler, who will be sitting down with Will Bodavis, the CEO of Phonaly.ai, a San Francisco-based startup building voice agents. And I'll be back in your feeds on Monday. Don't forget to send us your tax-specific questions. We're hard at work on a series of bonus episodes all about tax that we'll share with you at the end of the financial year. To never miss an episode, make sure you're following us on ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time.
Thank you. See ya.